great friend. There's no officer in the Army I admire more than General John Norton, the commanding general of the Army Aviation Materiel Command in St. Louis. Jack?
Well, I'll say thank you, General Bull Odin. You know, he's really not so docile. Members of the graduating classes and their very important families, and to everyone, ladies and gentlemen, good morning. You always look around when you come back to your old alma mater, and you try to find something that's particularly familiar. And I've looked real hard. I've been here almost 24 hours now, and I see it has changed in the exterior, but on the inside, it's the greatest spirit in the Army today, and I congratulate you on it, General Odin. It's a great spirit here at Fort Rucker. It's a real thing. And just to come back and feel it for 24 hours is a real thrill for me and my wife. Now, there's some more humorous sides to this. I can remember when we were fighting for our wings, it wasn't unusual to find out that your stage field was around the barracks you were living in, and all the wives and the kids could look out the windows and see you pulling pitch too soon or too late. And I can remember the instructor, you know, the personal instructor that says, now there's one in the book that we don't teach here, but you should know it. You may need it someday, and I recall he said, now we got 60-degree flaps on this thing, and someday you may need them. Let me show you how to use them. Well, everything went fine till I got my check ride. And I remember this tough Lieutenant Tom Smith. He didn't pay any attention to colonels or generals, I might add. But my first force landing, I had only one way to go to that pea patch, and that was with 60-degree flaps. And he really ripped me. You suppose I told him that Stockwell taught me to do that? I did that night after one drink and we got our wings. I remember when the Commandant, General Hutton, was distinguished for many things, and one was that he could land a helicopter with floats in the officer's swimming pool. And I do not believe that that was part of the safety program. I understand now that you've got the toughest man that's ever been here, and he's really got people, I'll say, flying straight. He's really punching hard on these traffic regulations, saving lives. But you ought to ask him about that new implement he's been practicing with a golf court. That's not part of the POI either. I've got to come to grips with my subject. I stood here in 62, thanks to General Easterbrook, trying to tell a group like you what I thought was the important lessons of being a flying soldier. And I thought I laid out a pretty good course on how to be a flying general officer in about 10 years. You know, every speaker likes to think he's gonna become immortal. How many of you can remember the subject of your high school graduation address? So I'm not fooling myself, but I tried, and my gosh, you know what they remembered? About a year later, some of these officers and wives showed up at Benning, and one of them said, boy, that was a mighty important speech you gave, General. I said, sure was. He said, you know that part you had in there about the most essential equipment for a student and a pilot after he got his wings is a wife that gets up and fixes him an early breakfast. You know, that caused more trouble in our family. But I know it's part of the course. I remember a chaplain, and I'll say, and also the surgeon here at those crucial days, and you could get things like hypoxia, and you could get things like hyperventilation. And if your blood sugar count wasn't up in the morning, you could flip the airplane. So I may not get too far this morning, but I want you to know I'm still in favor of every flying soldier having that wife that gets up early in the morning and fixes him at breakfast. Now, what do you say to that? hit 3 points this morning. One is how very important it is that you become a flyer. And what I will call the great significance of your being an Army aviator, and an Army aviator in a very difficult time of our history. And for many of you I know, four in this class have already been to Vietnam, but most of you will be on your way. And I'd like to speak about the significance of you being an Army aviator on your way to Vietnam, and finally your being an American in Vietnam. I don't mean to not include all the students here, but you'll grant me some specialties this morning, I'm sure. You make about two basic choices in this crazy life of ours, and after that, things are supposed to take over. You're supposed to pick a profession, you're supposed to pick a partner or a mate, and then you just follow along the mainstream. Now, you've complicated your life a little bit. You've gone one step further because you're not average. You've decided to fly. Now, in this contemporary political world we're in, some people are still arguing about whether they're going to work, and some people are still arguing about whether or not they're going to fight. But you've made those two tough decisions. You've picked a profession. If you're real fortunate, you've picked a mate, one that fixes breakfast, remember. And you're a flyer. And you're an Army combat aviator. And it's more than a program of instruction. It's more than an airplane. It's a way of life. I don't mean to propound the obvious too much, but it certainly does mean that you're lifted. Your horizons are way beyond anything you ever knew before. It's not a mechanical thing. I think it's an emotional, almost a spiritual thing. And you will see all sorts of new possibilities in your life. But as a military man, you become aware of the fact that it's by far the best way. You've got good oriented ground soldiers who are flying airplanes, and that's what I'm talking about. You'll do a much better job of winning, and I'll say in record time with minimum losses, and you know this. And the Army aviator today, as you've been told by many visitors here and your own travels throughout the Army, he's a very respected member of the Army. In many ways, he's the cement of the Army because the combat arms, the so-called technical administrative services, they ebb and flow through Army aviation. Probably the richest mix of young officers we've ever assembled in the history of our Army. And in my two scant years at Benning, I was never more amazed than when I looked into the faces of the young warrant officers, lieutenants and captains, and I'll say younger and younger majors too. But these men were truly triple threat. Airborne Ranger aviators anxious to get to combat. And this is certainly the finest thing I can say for our country, because we still measure our strength in terms of our young men who know the meaning of honest work and who will fight to defend what's theirs. And what we believe in and what's ours is the subject, I think, of what we're doing in Vietnam. Now, the school's prepared you well. You can take great confidence and remembering and doing what you've been taught here at the school. This same great man, Stockwell, that put me through my paces and left a few tattoos on my skin, I can still hear his voice. This old dog is just sitting out here waiting for you to make a mistake. And it's true. But you learn it again and again from different people. But essentially what you've been taught here in the school is combat oriented. It's basic, it's fundamental, and I can assure you, you can be confident that you have been well prepared for what lies ahead. If I had to stress anything, I'll trespass a bit, but if I had to stress anything, I think it would be these things. In everything you do, particularly in Vietnam, insofar as practical, you keep your head out of that cockpit. There's an awful lot going on in Vietnam and outside the cockpit. So while a lot of things you've been sort of trained to do, and you occasionally want to sneak a peek, but you remember this. You keep your head out of that cockpit, particularly when you've got a good co-pilot to help you. And there are times when the Air Force is all over the place. There's time when the artillery is falling all over the place. And there's certainly lots of times when aircraft are coming from every side of the LZ. And it's true that in the first 2 years over there, people were too much in the cockpit, and we lost too many aircraft and people, frankly, just because they didn't observe normal traffic rules. And you'll be using revetments over there. You're going to find how very important it is you keep your head out of the cockpit so you know where that revetment is and you know where your skids are. If I don't say anything else this morning, I'd say you keep your head out of the cockpit. Now, you've been reading about the attacks against our bases. And I'll come back to this and what it really means, but the enemy's always had the capability to get in close enough to lob a few rounds of either recoilless rifle fire or mortar fire into the bases. It's either a nuisance type raid or a psychological type raid. Occasionally it's for real. But you have to remember that you're probably more vulnerable when you're not in the air. That may sound awful hard for a guy who likes to fly, but it's true. You're probably more vulnerable when you're not in the air than any other time. And while it's true crews need a rest, you're no different than you've always been as a soldier. You have to be very wary of the question of security. Some of you may be considering yourself just as pilots. Some of you will be aviation unit commanders before you know it. And some of you will be vital to a commander who has the responsibility of an air mobile force, and you'll be a staff officer. But think about the security on the ground, because our attrition, not for pilots, thank the good Lord, but for aircraft. Our attrition in the last 3 months is almost double. Our treble, losses on the ground due to enemy fire, enemy attack. It takes a very wary army then to avoid taking these losses on the ground. Third thing I would stress, and it's real basic, but since I can say it happened in my division, no matter how hard we worked in the chain of command, you must, gentlemen, dedicate yourself not only being lean and mean, but stay clean out there. When I say stay clean, I mean you know what a crew of a helicopter should look like, you know what the helicopter should look like, and you know you're not supposed to take along a bunch of junk. And if your weapons ever get rusty, you're just a lousy soldier. And no matter how hard you're pressed, no matter how much pressure from the enemy, lean and mean and clean, you protect that helicopter so that when your time comes to haul a max load, you can haul it. So I'll just repeat, keep your head out of the cockpit. Remember that you're more vulnerable when you're not in the air. And keep your machine and your crew lean, clean, and mean. A lot of things have been said around the country about the war. And I think I should say a few words about it. Because 2 years over there is almost enough to say I believe more than I can possibly tell you about it. If I let myself go, I'd have to say that if I listen to all the announcements that are being made, I sometimes think that maybe Ho Chi Minh's running for office. Now, that may sound terrible, but believe me, we're at a very crucial time in our history, and the excitement has worn off, and for you, it's a deadly serious proposition. You're going to Vietnam. And I believe, frankly, this is what lies ahead of you. You're going to know firsthand how terrible this enemy is. And the atrocities of the Germans, and we fought them in two wars, and the atrocities of the Japanese. Everybody wants to put these things aside, but historically, I'd say this new enemy almost puts them to shame. It's the most terrible, terroristic form of attack we've known in the history of our country. And no matter what you think about the beginning of the war, we're now in the middle of it. And we are up against that type of enemy, a ruthless, completely ruthless, cunning enemy, and smart enough to know that if we have any doubts in this country about having to work, or if we have any doubts in this country about having to fight, that enemy is going to exploit this. And you feel it on the ground in Vietnam. You actually feel it. But you'll join the finest body of men that's ever been put on a battlefield. You'll almost be able to forget about this other type of attack, really the attack against our home front. You will see the enemy in all forms. The conventional enemy that now has tanks, he has artillery, there's no limit to what we're going to find up on the northern front. And the enemy that still haunts the rear areas, the guerrilla, and the so-called underground, this the Army has learned to master. And I like to put those attacks in perspective that took place during the Tet season. It was a crazy Tet season. Well, you might say everybody sort of forgets for a few days and they go back to their native traditions. But you know, there are 44 provinces. Each one of them has a capital. And it's a symbol of the integrity of the country. It's a symbol of our ability to defend that country. And there are about 240 districts. And each district has a headquarters, which is also a symbol of who's winning. You add them up, you get about 300 targets. And outside of these, I'll be conservative, there must be another 50 critical military sites, such as our own bases. The Korean Army has bases, and I'll just say their CP is about. So you can almost quickly add them up and say there are at least 350 targets. And what do you hear back here? The enemy attacked every major installation and caused great havoc. I submit to you, he hit 10% of them by selection, and it'd be absolutely impossible to deploy our forces and make any sense and protect 350 places at one time, particularly when most attacks are nuisance attacks. So really, he hit 10%. And that's the type of psychological warfare that we're up against. But you'll see some other things over there. You'll see Koreans, and the lesson of Korea should be with us. No matter what you remember about the war, we defended Korea. The Koreans are a very strong and grateful nation. And if we hadn't have done what we did, I think you'll find that historians agree that Korea would now be under the communist flag. And we'd have a very weak hold on the northern flank of the Far East. The Koreans are there in strength. And they're good soldiers. And they're holding a large part of the coastal area, the populated areas, where people have a chance, you might say, to get back to normal living and realize some of the benefits of this great defense that's being made over there. Our allies in the Vietnamese, let me say a word about them. I talked to many Vietnamese. I talked to many North Vietnamese who are now fighting for the South Vietnamese Army. Two of the regimental commanders of the 25th Division that I fought alongside, and the 22nd Division, had formerly fought with the Viet Minh. It was pretty clear to me why they were now fighting in South Vietnam. And please let me try to make this real clear. Whatever the enemy stood for, and he got the people's loyalty, he got the recruits. They were against the colonial occupation. We understand that. And then they were against the corrupt central government. But isn't it clear that what the VC were going to do, and I'll say the communist terrorists, that's what they really are, what they were going to do is after the expulsion of the French and after the liquidation of the corrupt central government, so-called, the next move was communist enslavement. And we were there to prevent that, and we're still there to prevent that. And now there have been two elections held. And with over 5 million people voting in the last election, and a man going to the polls over there, I say it's quite a moving experience, where often he has to fight to vote. But these are over 5 million people now who are committed to making a choice, not colonialism, not corrupt central government, and not communism, but to have a family, and to have a home, and to have a market. And if they choose one form of constitution or another, it's going to be free. And this is what the big fight's about. And now that they've voted, I don't see that the war is proceeding except on one course, and that's to reverse what these people have done in voting for themselves. And that's where I see the line has been drawn. And that's why we're still there. And that's a tough message. The Vietnamese people who have been fighting for 15 or 20 years, the young Dai Huy company commander who's been fighting 15 or 20 years, they really only ask you two questions. The people just want to know two things. Are we going to finish the job? You kind of have to demonstrate, you know how to do it. You know how to win without raping the countryside. And I thought we'd learned that pretty good, and I'm sure we have. So the answer is yes, we're there to finish the job. And number two, do we understand it's going to take a generation? Nobody's looking for a generation of heavy killing. Everybody'd like to see an end of that. But it's going to take a generation of patience and pursuit of securing and buttoning up what's been done. In other words, the same experience we've had in Europe, the same experience we've had in Korea, and this we must truly understand. Whenever the answer has been doubtful, whenever the people have felt doubtful about whether we were going to finish the job, whether we knew how long it took, I see that hamlet by hamlet, village by village, the American one-shot army that has a big fight, moves on, BC moved back in, and punished the people. So how can you really expect many people to sacrifice if they don't think you're going to finish the job, if they don't think you realize it's going to take a generation? And that's a tough one to crack, but I believe it's at the very roots of their ability to give completely of themselves. And when General Larson was here back in 67, he pointed out to the graduating class that in comparative terms, based on our previous wars, the Vietnamese have lost 10 million in this war compared to the percentage of losses in World War II by the Russians or the Germans. And how much of a price can a small country pay? And to put this on a positive note, our army, the Korean army, the Allies fighting in Vietnam, and the Vietnamese army, they are truly one team. And no matter what you hear about the sporadic attacks, I think this team knows how to beat the main forces, knows how to take on the guerrillas, and knows how to clean up the rear areas and get them on a going basis. But it's not going to be done overnight. And how can you expect an army in the field to lick the tough environment, lick all the problems of a tricky enemy, lick all the problems of coalition warfare, solve all the new tactics, particularly in the air mobile and counterinsurgency field, and then finally hear that they're racing the clock. And if we don't perform all of these miracles by a certain date, then everything is lost. And I submit to you, that's crazy. So I have gone a little bit far afield. But let me try to summarize. I congratulate you and your gals on moving ahead into the field of aviation. And at this stage of our history, it's very important that you are an Army aviator. It's very important that you have it in your heart to go to Vietnam and finish the job that has been begun. While you're an American and while you're an Army aviator, you'll be setting the pace for the rest of us. God bless you. Good luck.